You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vanderweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, February 9th, 2017.
There is this prevailing notion that if you are an excellent craftsman, you must also be an excellent human being.
Michael Glapp speaks with local builder, author, and storyteller Nancy Hiller in this week's edition of Big Talk, coming up later in the show.
Also coming up in the next half hour, our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks what Bloomington thinks about teacher pay. But first, these local headlines.
The Bloomington City Council is showing support for Mayor John Hamilton's proposed annexation of seven areas just outside the city's municipal boundaries. In the council meeting last night, City Attorney Philippa Guthrie said that many of the properties within the so-called two-mile fringe have already become urbanized.
They really are part of the community. They look like the city. They're just not within the boundaries. A lot of them are getting sewer and water. So they really are something that the city believes should be part of the community officially.
Guthrie explained some of the reasons the city is moving to annex these areas.
We believe that annexing these areas would provide some important enhancements to services. There would be, in one or two areas, new fire stations to cover the services for fire coverage, additional police officers, sanitation, street maintenance, recycling. The county doesn't have recycling at this time.
Guthrie says the city's broadband initiative would extend high-speed fiber to residents within annexation areas. Guthrie also cited a desire by city administration to help shape the area impacted by the creation of I-69. Much of the area to be annexed already receives city water and sewer. Guthrie said, when those residents signed up for services, they also signed a waiver agreeing not to contest annexation. Guthrie said changes in the state have motivated the city to move before it loses the ability to annex. Some council members expressed concern about how much money the county would be losing. Councilmember Chris Sturbaum asked City Controller Jeff Underwood whether the city's new revenue essentially comes out of the county's pocket.
It's a little complicated because some taxes will move over, others will be new taxes. We're allowed to have a adjustment to our tax levy, so that would be a new revenue because it is a new tax. The county would continue to keep their current levy, so they will not lose any property tax money. Basically, the only thing that comes that the county loses is we would have a larger share of the county option income tax and the public safety lit, because that's based on distributive shares, which is based on population. So they would lose that money, but all of their other revenues, so monies they get from motor vehicle highway and their local road and street and their general fund are all protected.
Sturbaum also questioned the idea put forth by the administration that the annexation would be a revenue neutral for the city. Underwood said typically with annexations, quote, the costs end up equaling the additional revenue. Only a few members of the public spoke during the public comment portion of the meeting. Art Olnick of Lanham Road asked whether the residents in his area would be forced to pave their gravel road and accept sewer services they may not need. Underwood responded,
we would not force them to pave that road. On the sewer, again, 51% of the people would have to petition to have the sewer extended. They would make deposits, and then we would extend it. There's no requirement, again, that any individual that wasn't in that 51% would be required to connect unless at some point they had a failing septic system.
Richard Martin, a member of the Monroe County Redevelopment Commission, also addressed the city council during the public comment. Martin urged the council to look at the proposed annexation very carefully.
There are good reasons to annex
parts of this property into the city, and I would like you to be very diligent in looking at both the pros and the cons, and be very careful about the fiscal constraints, because the cost of this infrastructure and these services is going to be higher than we expect, always seems to be, and our ability to generate revenue is going to be lower than we desire, it always is.
If the City Council approves the initial resolutions for annexation in its next meeting on February 15th, it will only be the first step in a larger process. Guthrie says actual approval requires the creation of a city ordinance, and annexation would not take effect until 2020. In the meantime, the city is required by state law to hold 6 public information sessions, which are currently scheduled for March 20th through the 25th at City Hall. A final public hearing is anticipated in late May. Information on the areas of annexation is available at the city's website, bloomington.in.gov. Residents can provide feedback through an online form until tomorrow.
Another in a long series of tax court battles between CBS and the Monroe County government is scheduled for tomorrow morning. A judge is scheduled to hear the property tax case at 10 a.m. in the Moot Courtroom at the Indiana University Maurer School of Law. Over the past few years, all 7 CVS stores in Monroe County have sought to reduce their property taxes by appealing their property value assessments. Tomorrow's hearing is for the Ellisville location. County Assessor Judy Sharp says these kinds of appeals used to be rare, but they've become more common recently.
So about 3 years ago is when this started. And it started because the state of Michigan had Meijer's store. And Meijer's is situated, the headquarters is in Michigan. And they came up with this idea of, you know, we'll build $100 million plus new Meijer's store, but then we're going to come in and say, oh, it's not worth that, because if this was sitting empty, it would only be pennies on the dollar.
Meijer's argument later became known as the dark box method, and variations on the method have been used in Indiana. In a ruling last November, a tax court judge ruled that the CVS store on North College Avenue could compare itself to a business that is not a, quote, successful ongoing CVS operation, unquote, in order to reduce its property taxes. The state legislature passed laws attempting to resolve the issue during 2015 and 16, but Sharp says assessors around the state are still fighting lots of cases. She estimates CVS and other large businesses in Monroe County have saved between $3 and $4 million during the past few years. Other local taxpayers must make up the difference.
Every one of you are going to be paying more on your taxes, because what happens is it's shifted. You have to get so much money to run the city and the county and the townships. That's the budget every year, and the tax rates based on that.
CVS is represented in tax court by Indianapolis-based attorney Paul Jones, who did not respond to a call for comment by our deadline. On his website, Jones says he's helped save $200,000 in property taxes for a coal store in Howard County last year. Jones has also represented a CVS location in a property tax case in Shelby County. In Monroe County, other businesses including Lowe's, Menards, and Target have also appealed their property assessments in recent years.
A new agriculture technology startup called the B Corp has been launched by former IU students. The B Corp monitors the conditions of more than 100 commercial beehives in southern and central Indiana. Honeybees contribute more than $15 billion a year to the U.S. economy, according to a 2014 White House fact sheet. The B Corp's vision, according to their website, is to support beekeepers in maintaining healthy honeybees that pollinate a diverse ecosystem and bountiful food supply. Founders Ellie Symes, Wyatt Wells, Lucas Moll, and Simon Kuntz are beginning further research and development. The B Corp will begin building sensing testers to measure the bees' needs and behaviors. This development will also reduce what is called colony collapse disorder, which occurs when worker bees leave behind their queen bee. Since the colony collapse disorder has gotten worse in recent years, beekeepers have seen a higher rate of hive loss. The B Corp's new technology will also predict any unusual activity in the queen bee's performance in order to prevent a loss of more colonies. The technology is known as Queen Guard Hive Alert System, telling them when the crucial time that they may need to intervene. This will optimize honey production and pollination in a way that protects beehive health. Indiana University alumni, and Indiana University Research and Technology Corporation have invested in the B Corp to guide and support the growing business. The founders are dedicated the next 6 months to research and prototype development.
The Indiana Department of Transportation is accepting applications for Governor's Summer Internships. The internships pay $11.30 per hour and offer up to $3,125 in scholarship funds per semester. INDOT will be accepting resumes for the summer internships until February 24th. Summer interns will spend 50% of their time on a project that will enhance college-level skills. Candidates must be enrolled as an undergraduate or a graduate student and must have 1 year of undergraduate education completed. More information on the 2017 Governor's Public Service Internship Program is available on the state's website at in.gov/spd/careers. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Ron Bronson. Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and television services, now offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
A cabinet maker, furniture designer and builder, author, preservation advocate, and storyteller, Nancy Hiller has been beautifying people's homes in Bloomington and other cities for years. She started working with wood as a young woman simply because she needed affordable furniture. She trained in the art and craft of woodworking on a dare and went on to make it her life. She's written the award-winning book, A Home of Her Own, a study of the places women live and own. Now she's releasing her fourth book, Making Things Work, Tales from a Cabinet Maker's Life, due out in mid-March. She joins Michael Glab on this week's edition of Big Talk.
Hi, this is Big Talk, Michael Glab here. My guest today is Nancy Hiller. Nancy is a woodworker.
Well, it's true, I'm a woodworker, but that is a huge category, actually, because there are woodworkers who turn decorative pens, and there are woodworkers who carve spoons or clogs. There are woodworkers who are joiners and carpenters, so I prefer to identify myself as a cabinet maker. It's a term that encompasses built-ins and freestanding furniture. In England, which is where I trained many, many years ago, the word pretty much was always just cabinet maker.
There are these television shows having to do with making tables or making chairs. And I think a lot of people watch and a lot of people wish they could start doing it, but it costs a lot of money to get into this business, doesn't it? There's a lot of tools. You have to have a space. And you have to know what the heck you're doing.
Well, that is the common perception, but some of the people I know, and certainly I fall into this category, didn't have any of those things when we started. So we just wanted to make things. So back in the late 1970s, when my then boyfriend and I had no furniture to speak of, and we wanted some furniture, and we couldn't afford furniture on what money we were making at our very low-paid jobs. I just started cobbling things together because I guess I wasn't afraid to. I had no idea whatsoever of what I was doing, but that didn't stop me. And I didn't have any tools. I just borrowed my boyfriend's hardware store tools and literally sawed pieces of wood by hand with his carpenter's saw, either like on a chair or on our table. It wasn't a fancy dining table. It was a little gate leg table that my mother had bought at a junk shop years before and given me. I mean, because if you want to do something, you do it. The reason I ended up going for a basic furniture training is because my stepfather would constantly come by and visit and just never failed to criticize what I was doing. And one day he added, "You should take a carpentry course," to his usual insult. And we had such a contentious relationship that to spite him, I called up the local vocational college, which had a woodworking department, and asked about training programs. And I ended up quitting my factory job and going to the vocational college, where I did a City and Guilds certificate in furniture making.
Nancy, that's an interesting story about how you got involved in woodworking, which brings us to the fact that you have a whole book of stories coming up next month, mid-March. There's a book coming out called Making Things Work, Tales from a Cabinet Maker's Life, and that cabinet maker's life is yours. Your book you're coming out with. How did that come about?
It's something I've been wanting to do for years. I mean, over the years, I have been involved in authoring a couple of other books, quite frankly, although I am a full-time furniture and cabinet maker, I love to do research and writing as well. Before I had written either of those books, I had already decided I wanted to write another book, which is the book that is now forthcoming. And of course, the title has a double meaning. Making Things Work is, of course, about the work of making things. But it is also a word, an expression that I certainly use on an almost daily basis to indicate how we get things done. Let's just make it work.
You don't want anybody thinking that this is any kind of a memoir.
Right. It is not written as a memoir. This book uses memoir as a tool. It is not memoir as an end. I draw on stories and experiences from my own life to make certain points. So the first of the three sections is more narrative and chronological, but it deals with the time that I spent in England, and it basically sets up some themes, that is, how I came to be in England and how I came to train as a furniture maker and the first three jobs that I had in workshops in England, each of which was an absolute trip, culminating in a short-term temporary job at the Imperial War Museum at Duxford near Cambridge, which was a complete fabulous blast because of my co-workers there, who were all unabashedly sexist and uninhibited in their use of the English language. It was a super great time. It was very fun, and we got along like gangbusters. I loved those guys. The second section of the book is called Dream On. And the overarching theme of that section is basically pulling apart some of the fantasies and myths that surround a life of woodworking.
What does this mean?
There is this prevailing notion that if you are an excellent craftsman, you must also be an excellent human being. I should add that the identities have been changed. The third section is more about... The third section deals with the everyday business of making things work.
Nancy, I love your stories. I can't wait to read the book, and I'm going to repeat the title of it again. It is Making Things Work, Tales from a Cabinet Maker's Life. We're expecting it out in mid-March. Where can somebody get this book?
It will be available locally at the Book Corner or through the N.R. Hiller Design website. The address is nrhillerdesign.com. You would want to go to the section called Books.
Nancy Hiller, thanks so much for joining us on Big Talk.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. I'm a big fan of you and your Big Talk.
Support for WFHB comes from Monster Digital Marketing, offering digital marketing solutions for small businesses. Monster Digital Marketing websites are built for search engine optimization with both the desktop and the mobile device user in mind. Located at monsterdigitalmarketing.com or on the phone at 317-567-1197.
Up next is our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
This week on Voices in the Street, do you think public school teachers are paid enough? The narrow confirmation of President Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education has served as a reminder of just how important education, and especially how important the public school system is. We have gone out into the streets and asked your fellow Bloomingtonians whether public school teachers are paid enough.
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no. I think it honestly depends on a teacher-to-teacher basis. I've had a lot of teachers where I think, no, this teacher needs hell of a raise. Then I've had others where I'm like, I could learn this from a book.
No, because I think that they work a lot more hours than they're set to work. And I think that they work a lot harder than people think that they do. And I think it's a very stressful job with a lot of expectations that they're not getting paid for, as well as the fact that we're the lowest paid teachers in the modern world, it seems like. I think most advanced countries do far better than we do. So I think that's bad.
I think that it's a profession that they don't really do it for the pay. And so I think that no, because it's a very important profession, but I think that getting them to have more pay is probably not the main concern in public education currently.
No.
Why?
Well, if you compare it to the private school teachers, they make more money, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I just think it's the foundation of education, so they should probably get more money. I think police officers and firefighters are all them, too.
No, because I think they should be paid more than, what, $40,000 a year?
No, I do not think so, because they put in a lot of hard work and effort, and I just don't think it's a reasonable amount.
No. They have a really difficult job with too many rules, regulations, and restrictions on what they do, and they should be paid more and allowed more freedom in what they teach and the way they teach it.
No. They are very important to the education success of the children they teach, and I think they should be better compensated.
Depends. I don't know. Like, I know some get paid more than others, depending on how long they've been there.
Yeah, you know, I think they are.
Yeah.
I think they have a pension and, you know, they have all those benefits. I think they are paid enough right now.
I don't know. I just, like, really, back in the day, I respected my teachers a lot, and they just honestly never seemed like, for the work that they put into it, that they got paid enough.
My sister was a school teacher for 37 years, and she was not paid enough.
I think they have a lot of responsibility, and there is a lot more that goes into their job other than just the, you know, 8 or 9 a.m. to 2 or 3 p.m. Yeah. They take a lot of work home with them. I have a lot of respect for teachers because they are shaping and molding our future leaders of America, and yeah, I guess I think they just deserve higher pay.
I'm not sure how much they make. I think some definitely need to make more, and I think some definitely need to be fired.
I don't know their exact salary on average, but if I had to give you an answer, I think they're very undervalued. And so, I mean, yeah, I don't think they're paid enough, no.
They work very hard, and I just don't think they're paid nearly what they're worth, which is why it's hard to get science and math teachers.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jade Schoppel, Carly Van Cleve, and Joe Crawford, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glab.
Voices in the Street was produced by Barbara Van Przowski. Our engineer today is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Ron Bronson.
And I'm Carolyn Vanderweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered independent daily news program.
If you use iTunes, you can have the show delivered to you directly. Just go to the iTunes store, search for WFHB Daily Local News, and subscribe to our podcast.
Stay tuned for Blooming Out, Indiana's only LGBTQI public affairs show, coming up next here on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.